This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The Mississippi River is the largest river-based ecosystem in North America and the third largest of its kind in the world. The ecosystem supports more than 300 species of birds, 150 fish species, and many more species of plants and animals. Human activity has had a variety of impacts on this resource, including the depletion of floodplain forests. Joining us to talk about these important habitats and regional efforts to restore them are Meredith Thompson, biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Andy Meyer, forester for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and Andy Beebe, forester from Audubon, Minnesota. And first, I just want to start the conversation by talking about, you know, what is a floodplain forest? So, Andy Meyer, can you just kind of explain, you know, what a floodplain forest is?
So I think in order to even put the context of what a floodplain forest is, we probably need to understand what a floodplain is and what we're talking about when we talk about a floodplain. A lot of people might think of a floodplain as just where the river travels. And so if you went outside of La Crosse and drove over the bridge into Minnesota, you'd see the river flowing underneath the bridge. Maybe you'd think that was the floodplain. But the floodplain is really considered to be the entire area in which the river would potentially flood in a high water or a high water event. If you want to kind of think of it in the way that people in the area would be familiar with it. Really, if you look between the railroad tracks along the Mississippi River are really good guide for where the edge of the floodplain is. Basically, once you get outside of those railroad tracks, and you know this varies significantly depending on where you're at, but generally speaking, once you're outside the railroad tracks, you're kind of in an area that's outside of the flood zone. And so those are kind of the east and west boundaries that we would put on the floodplain. A floodplain forest specifically is basically just a forest that grows in that floodplain. And you can kind of differentiate it from the bluff forests that are around the river, largely by the tree species that occur within the floodplain forest. And we have a different suite of tree species that occur within the floodplain forest that are tolerant of a certain level of flooding. Most tree species that you find outside of river floodplains are very sensitive to flooding, and so if they were underwater for more than a couple days a year, they would essentially die. But we have tree species in the floodplain that are incredibly tolerant of flooding. Some of them, like silver maple, can survive 60 to 70 days a year of flooding and still be all right. So the tree species are really unique within the floodplain in that they're able to tolerate that kind of water conditions, and it makes for a really unique ecosystem that's not found in a lot of other places, because it requires that regular flood event and that flow of water in order to sustain it.
And as we're going to talk about today, you know, floodplain forests have, changed a lot due to human activity. And, you know, Meredith, I wonder if you can talk about kind of what these floodplain forests look like before settlement.
We know that the floodplain forest pre-settlement was a pretty diverse mosaic of habitat types. So we use that term in ecology a lot. We talk about habitat mosaics. So just like the different colors of tile make a picture in a mosaic, the different types of habitats that you'd find within a given area create that habitat mosaic. And so we know that in places that have water in them year-round, we would have had, emergent aquatic vegetation. We would have had some marsh-dominated places. We would have had shrubbier areas with things like sandbar willow and buttonbush in it. And then we would have had a mix of different combinations of tree species in forested stands in the floodplain. So we know a little bit about what was out there from the survey data when they came through right before settlement was opened up in our area. They would mark the corridor sections and make a record of what kind of trees were at each of those locations. And so we can, to an extent, recreate what kind of forests were in our area then. We know that there was more river birch and some of the other sort of earlier successional species in the floodplain at that time of settlement, maybe representing some, more frequent fire history in the area at that time. But a lot of the same species as we see today, cottonwood, we see some places with, there's an oak species that's tolerant to flooding called swamp white oak that we'd see in some areas as well.
And now, are floodplain forests something you see along the entire length of the Mississippi River? Are they unique to kind of the upper Mississippi?
The floodplain forests that we have in this part of the Mississippi River are somewhat unique. The Mississippi River is really kind of broken up into a number of different sections, and the upper Mississippi River is one that's sort of defined by the lock and dam system that the Corps of Engineers manages. Below about the confluence of the Ohio River and the Mississippi River in southern Illinois, the river is considered kind of the middle Mississippi, and it's much more driven by a levee system that was installed more to control floods than to provide for navigation. And in that area, the forest tends to be outside of those levees, so it's instead of being a forest that's subjected to flooding on a regular basis, it's a forest that's been separated from flooding, and so there are a different series of issues there, and a large amount of the land farther south has been converted into agriculture adjacent to the river, and then as you get even farther south into the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, there are extensive bottomland hardwood forests, but you're getting to be so far south that it's largely a completely different suite of tree species. You have dozens of different oak species that can occur there. You have bald cypress, which is a grand old tree that can live to 1,000 years old, living in these swamps completely underwater all year round. So there are floodplain forests there, but they're of a completely different group of species. And by the time the Mississippi River gets to the Gulf of Mexico, it's changed significantly in the way it behaves. And so the species that we have here wouldn't be able to do nearly as well at the southern end of the river as they do up here. So really, this piece of floodplain forest is an incredibly unique habitat. In the upper Midwest, there's really no contiguous tract of floodplain forest like this, and because of the unique suite of tree species that we have here, it's really a unique habitat for much of the United States, even to the point of being... A few years ago, it was declared, the whole upper Mississippi River was declared a wetland of global importance by the Ramsar Convention, which is recognition that this is a globally valuable resource, and the floodplain forest is a key component of that.
And Meredith was talking about kind of what we know these floodplain forests look like pre-settlement. And Andy Beebe, I wonder if you can give us a feel of, you know, what the floodplain forests look like right now. What is the current state of things?
The river definitely defines the floodplain forest quite a bit. We have a system of locks and dams that create quite extensive forests behind the locks and dams where soil and sediment has built up over the course of many years since the installation of the locks and dams. So we have these large tracts of floodplain forest that kind of slowly break away as you go south from each lock and dam and fold into a system of braided islands and channels. So we have higher spots next to the locks and dams where we have much more diversity, higher islands, some that are man-made that are pretty diverse, and lots of low areas with predominantly silver maple and cottonwood and other lowland species.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about efforts to restore floodplain forests along the upper Mississippi River. We're here with Andy Beebe from Audubon, Minnesota, Andy Meyer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and UWL biology professor Meredith Thompson. And Meredith, why should people care about floodplain forests? Why is this an issue that we really need to be looking at and working to address?
Well, we have definitely lost extensive areas of floodplain forest, since settlement. Even back to the very earliest days of steamboat travel, they were cutting wood along the river courses to fuel the steamboats. And so the assault sort of on floodplain forest started that long ago. More recently, like Andy was talking about with the creation of the lock and dams, upstream from each lock and dam, there's a large impounded area, that sort of lake-like part of each navigation pool that would have had forest in it that has now, you know, gone underwater and that doesn't support forest anymore. So just because of that land use history, we have lost a lot of area. And so there's a lot of interest in conserving what we have left and maybe even getting back some more where we have lost it. The reasons for doing that are, you know, wide. I might actually defer to Andy Beebe here from Audubon to talk a little bit about the animal and particularly bird side. But I'd like to say, you know, on a more personal level, how much I love this habitat. I grew up in northern Minnesota on Lake Superior, and so coming here and learning to understand the river was a learning process for me. It was really not an ecosystem I had any kind of experience with or understanding of, and I guess the thing that I think is the most amazing about it is how much it changes through the year. So I just walked on the Great River State Trail north of Lytle's Landing, north of La Crosse, sort of out of Bryce Prairie this weekend, and you can walk on the embankment there, and it's like you're in a boat, right? The water is way up in the woods on both sides. There's current through there. It's really just extraordinary to be in those woods, like, you know, it's a forest that's a lake or a river at the same time. And so many different kinds of birds in there right now. You'll see ducks. You'll see the migrating warblers and other things. You know, later in the season, that'll be really wet and muddy and hard to get around in. And I'll tell you that that's not my favorite time of year in the floodplain. And then in the winter, once it's frozen and the ground is harder and all those channels are frozen up, that's probably the easiest time of year to be in there. And you can really poke around and see the, you know, different water courses and the different ways that the habitats kind of grade into each other. It's a neat time to explore the floodplain.
Andy Beebe, can you touch on, you know, why we should care about restoring these forests from a fish and wildlife perspective?
Yeah, definitely. So the refuge itself is a massive resource, a massive refuge, if you will, which is probably one of the biggest reasons why it is so important. It represents 261 river miles, so it's just a huge refuge that offers a lot of space for wildlife to the wildlife both that migrate through and that live here year-round to utilize and be free from human disturbance. And in this day and age, you know, human disturbance is a huge factor that negatively impacts wildlife. So just the fact that it is so large and is readily available here is a huge asset. The refuge also supports 40% of the nation's waterfowl, so that's a massive number. You know, I think that really speaks for itself. We have lots of migrating waterfowl, both game and non-game species. So there's some human uses there, game birds, some hunting applications there that have a lot of useful aspects there that a lot of folks can understand that, and then plenty of waterfowl also that are just intrinsically value and present a lot of ecosystem services there. On the refuge, we have 305 species of birds that use it at any given time, or at least at some point during the year. 105 of those species breed on the refuge, and just to give you an idea of the species of birds in North America, there are little over 900, I believe. So we have a third of the species of birds in North America that are utilizing the refuge at a certain time during the year, either breeding here or migrating through. So just a huge number there. We have 331 pairs of breeding bald eagles. That represents, I believe it's like 5% of the U.S. population. So you can see the numbers are just staggering as to what species are supported by the refuge. It's also an important bird area that's recognized by Audubon, so it plays a hugely important role into many different wildlife species and birds especially.
Yeah, and Andy Meyer, you know, we've started to kind of touch on how human activity has really impacted these floodplain forests, but I wonder if you can go into the specifics of, you know, what activities have really taken a toll on these forests.
That's a really important question, I think. A lot of people see a forest out there and they think, well, this is how it has always been and this is how it will always be, but these forests everywhere, and forests specifically in the Mississippi River floodplain, are ever-changing systems. I was just last week, I was out at Goose Island, which many listeners probably will be familiar with, just south of La Crosse. And most people know Goose Island as a heavily forested, you know, sort of respite from the busy city life of La Crosse. You know, you go down there and you can put your kayak in the water, or you can go camping at the campground there. And the Corps of Engineers actually owns a fair amount of the land that's in Goose Island. So we were doing a little bit of work there, trying to identify some sites where we could do a little bit of invasive species work. And I just got to thinking, well, I should go back and have a look at the old aerial photographs of Goose Island. One of the one of the really neat things that we can do is we've got aerial photographs that go all the way back to the 1920s and 30s and actually look at what a lot of these areas looked like. And Goose Island is a classic example of a site that prior to the establishment of the refuge and the locks and dam systems in the 1930s, much of the river was privately owned. And so a lot of the area that's actually in the Upper Mississippi River Refuge was agricultural land, had been developed at that point. And Goose Island's a classic case. It was all farm fields in the 1920s, or for the most part. I mean, there was some marsh mixed in where it was too wet to farm. But in most of the places in the floodplain where you had dry enough ground to farm, there almost certainly was some level of agriculture that was occurring. And so it's interesting to think when the locks and dams were put in, you know, there, one side of it was that a lot of forest land was lost because it went underwater. But on the other hand, a lot of forest land was gained because land that would otherwise have been in agriculture or otherwise have been in non-forested conditions was brought back into forest. Going a little bit farther back, there are a lot of interesting things that have played a role in the river. But Meredith mentioned the role of steamboats, and it's really kind of fascinating to think about. You know, again, people wouldn't think about steamboats as having an impact on floodplain forest, but a really interesting fact as you start thinking about it is that steamboats were the main method of commerce back in the mid-1800s, and material was transported from all the way, you know, from St. Louis all the way up to the Twin Cities by steamboat. And those things had to be run by some sort of power. We didn't have electricity at the time. We hadn't even really started utilizing coal at the time. We didn't have nuclear power by any means, so that wasn't an option. Wood was the fuel of choice, and one of those steamboats, it's estimated, would have burned about 10 cords of wood a day in order to run. Now, for some people who don't heat their homes with wood, 10 cords doesn't really mean anything. But 10 cords of wood, you know, for a family that's got an average size house that burns, you know, that maybe heats partially with wood, that's maybe the amount of wood that they'd go through in a winter. And so you've got one steamboat that's burning that much wood in one day. And there were hundreds of steamboats going up and down the river. So it follows that there were a lot of people who were living along the river, cutting trees and basically stacking up firewood along the edges of the river in order to support the steamboats. So that was an initial disturbance that had some impact on the forest that we have today. Then people came in and developed the land and used it for agriculture. Then the lock and dam systems came in. And then we get to where we're at today, with all of those different layers playing into it. And in all honesty, I don't think we have a very good understanding of how each of those pieces contributed to what we have today.
That's Andy Meyer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, here with us today to talk about the state of floodplain forests and why they're important to the Mississippi River ecosystem. Also joining us is Andy Beebe from Audubon, Minnesota, and UWL biology professor Meredith Thompson. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. So we're talking about, you know, how human activity has really impacted these floodplain forests, but now, you know, a lot of organizations are looking at these forest lands and working to try to restore them. And Meredith, can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing through UWL with these forest lands?
Yeah, so I will say partners right away, because none of this work has been done in a vacuum. Since I started at UWL 11 years ago, I have been working with the foresters at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and we've done a number of different projects to restore floodplain forest in areas that have been invaded by reed canarygrass, and we have somehow made it this far in the conversation without even saying reed canarygrass yet, even though that sort of dominates my thinking about the system, at least. Reed canarygrass is a very fast-growing, highly competitive species of grass that is extremely common in wet sites throughout Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, and it is a really dominant force in the floodplain. It readily establishes in areas of bare ground. It loves high light levels. It loves the fertile soil that we find in the floodplain forest. And so Places that have reed canary grass in them often have very little else. My colleague said to me the other day that if you think about it, you go out in a cornfield and you'd probably see a bigger variety of kinds of plants in that field just because of agricultural weeds. You'd see more kinds of plants in that cornfield than you see in a typical reed canary grass stand. It is a very dominant competitor and really, really does a number on young trees especially. So places where forest canopy gaps are created, where big trees fall down and light gets down to the soil surface, where you'd normally expect to see young trees come up and grow up into bigger individuals, those sites often become dominated by reed canary grass. And we really do have concerns about, over the long term, will we sort of see forest lost little by little as those gap openings are dominated by the grass instead of by young trees. So the work I have been doing with Army Corps, with Minnesota and Wisconsin DNR, with the Fish and Wildlife Service, these different entities are interested in finding solutions for getting trees into places that are currently dominated by reed canary grass. And so we do site treatments involving some soil disturbance, involving some herbicide applications, where we can really knock back that grass and get the site back to a condition where young trees can establish and grow. So it's kind of like ripping this big carpet of grass back and opening up the area for the growth of these young trees. They come up fast. You know, we see trees growing easily a foot, sometimes 2 feet in a year, growing up in this dense thicket of young seedlings and really creating a very different type of habitat very quickly. We see responses in the animals right away too. Some of my sites by year 3 or 4 became almost impossible to work in because the red-winged blackbirds were nesting in there and they were so annoying, flying at us while we were trying to measure these young trees. And so it's fun to watch those projects go forward and see the changes in that ecosystem. You know, once the trees are that big, once the trees are overhead, I feel like they're pretty much out of competition with reed canary grass. They're safe from deer browsing, and they're tall enough to survive most floods. So, you know, I should knock on wood saying this, but I think you get them that tall, and you're kind of home free that you will have a forest there for a good, boy, I am nervous saying this, but for a good 50 or 70 years, if all cooperates.
And now reed canary grass is an invasive species, right?
That's correct. But I will say that it is an invasive species whose geographic origin is a current area of research, right? So invasiveness is sort of like a behavior. It's how a plant behaves in an ecosystem or any organism behaves in an ecosystem. And the question of where it comes from is a separate issue. We often think about non-native invasive species, and certainly those are most common. But the evidence is really supporting the idea now that reed canary grass was in North America pre-settlement. It's a pan-temperate species, or circum-temperate, if you want to call it that, like something that was really widely spread in the northern temperate regions of the globe, and that introductions of genotypes from Europe have largely replaced the native strain of reed canary grass, so that we have European reed canary grass here now, but technically evidence suggests that the species was here prior to settlement.
And I think that point that Meredith brings up about reed canary grass being sort of, you know, it's questionable whether or not it's a native or a non-native species. The point is not so much whether it's native or non-native, but the point is the effect that it's having on the ecosystem. And so, you know, the Corps of Engineers manages about 28,000 acres of floodplain forest between Minneapolis and essentially a little south of Prairie du Chien, at least our district does. And throughout that area, we see failures of forest regeneration all over the place that in a lot of cases can be attributed to reed canary grass, but we also have other places where the forest canopy opens up and stinging nettle 10 foot tall fills in those gaps. And stinging nettle, I don't think anyone would argue, is a non-native species. There would be some that would argue that it's a non-pleasant species, but but be that as it may, it's a native species. It's been here as long as we know, but it's behaving in those areas as something that's inhibiting forest regeneration. And so, obviously, in order to have a forest 100 years from now, we need to have small trees regenerating in the forest right now. And so, reed canary grass is part of that big concern about the fact that these forests just are not regenerating on their own. And we're in the process of trying to figure out how we can help them to regenerate more efficiently and ensure that there's going to be that forest there in the long run.
And Meredith, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how students here at UWL are involved in your project.
Oh, for sure. I have been lucky to have help from a lot of different students, both undergraduate students and graduate students in our master's program in biology, really have taken the lead on a lot of this research, pushing it forward student by student. We have a number of ways of supporting undergraduate researchers. I've had folks who come out just for a day or two, and I've had students who have worked for me with me for an entire summer and contributed to scientific publications on reed canary grass, working in the field, working in the greenhouse, doing competition experiments. I'm really interested in collaborating with some of my colleagues in geography and earth sciences on some remote sensing projects involving reed canary grass as well. So there's a lot of ways we can use our student researchers and use our expertise at UWL to address this problem.
And you mentioned that, you know, you have seen some successes of, you know, trees growing up and you know, those habitats seeming to come back. But, you know, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how, I guess, widespread these locations are? Is it just in the La Crosse-La Crescent area? Are you guys identifying other areas in this region?
I would say that, you know, sort of this upper Miss refuge, that there are places that we would like to ultimately do this work throughout that area. My own work has been focused in La Crosse, but we have a new project going in now in collaboration with Audubon, Minnesota, with sites running from close to Red Wing, Minnesota, down to just north of the Iowa border. That's work that we're carrying out with support from the state of Minnesota, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund, to do really large-scale testing of a few different alternate strategies for knocking back reed canary grass, and then also testing the best ways to get plants growing in those sites.
UWL biology professor Meredith Thompson is here with us today to talk about regional efforts to restore floodplain forests along the Mississippi River. She's joined by Andy Meyer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Andy Beebe from Audubon, Minnesota. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the importance of forest land for plants and animals along the Mississippi River. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about floodplain forests along the Mississippi River. Agriculture, logging, and other human activity has depleted these unique habitats over the years, impacting the larger river ecosystem. But organizations on national, state, and local levels are working to restore these forest lands and plan for the future of the river. Joining us to talk about floodplain forests are Meredith Thompson, biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Andy Meyer, forester for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and Andy Beebe, forester from Audubon, Minnesota. Before the break, Meredith was just talking about some of the projects that she's working on. And, you know, you mentioned that you're starting to work on projects in the La Crescent area with Audubon, Minnesota. So, Andy Beebe, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of these projects that Audubon, Minnesota is starting to work on.
Yeah, so last Thursday, actually, we just wrapped up our long and arduous planting season. And just kind of a point to talk about with planting on the floodplain, it's a whole lot different than tree planting that you might be used to in your yard or in anywhere where it's dry, really. A lot of our planting, well, we do a lot of planting in the spring and in the fall, and it can really be inhibited by high water. So we had a struggle to get all these trees in the ground this spring, but we did do it. We ended up planting, for the research projects at least, we ended up planting a little bit better than 12,000 bare root trees and 1,500 RPM trees. So there's a cool point too. We're experimenting with lots of different nursery stock materials. So the listener base might be familiar with bare root trees. It's essentially a young tree, 1 to 2 years old, that's been dug up. The roots have been washed off, and it's delivered from a nursery, and you can plant it in relatively easy, relatively quickly. But we're also planting these RPM trees, root production method trees, that are essentially potted plants, but they've been grown with a proprietary method, a proprietary nutrient blend from a nursery down in Missouri, actually. And these trees are massive compared to what you might be used to with containerized stock. They're almost all of the trees that we're planting, the containerized stock, are one-year-old trees. And they're just huge trees. They're probably on the average of about 7 to 10 feet tall. And logistically can be pretty difficult to transport around. So planting is quite a process, but we hope by planting such a great diversity of stock that we'll have great results and ultimately be able to determine what stock works the best to reforest on the floodplain and replace re-canary grass with trees.
And what are the larger goals that Audubon Minnesota has when it comes to floodplain forests? You know, what are you guys really working toward?
We are. So our partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife is pretty new. It's about 2.5 to 3 years old. And we're really just trying to figure out how we can reforest the floodplain, take invasive species, primarily re-canary grass, monocultures, and within the woods itself where we have re-canary grass, and manage that and figure out the best way to grow trees back over top re-canary grass, and also just ensure that forests that are forests today are forests tomorrow. So that's kind of the broad goals that we have. We're working with the refuge. Floodplain forests are the refuge number one resource of concern as far as habitat types go. So we're just working in coordination and trying to see what we can do to ensure that we have forests into continuation.
And Andy Meyer, you know, we've been mentioning a lot of different organizations that kind of have a hand in this work. And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, how all of the different organizations on national, state, mm-hmm. Levels all kind of work together.
Yeah. The Upper Mississippi River is actually a really amazing example of interagency cooperation. I think if you go a lot of different places and you told one federal agency that we're working in an area where we've got three or four federal agencies interacting with four or five state agencies and a bunch of private NGOs, it would just blow their minds to think about that. It's a really interesting framework because the Upper Mississippi River is a large part of the floodplain, and this part of the river is owned by the federal government as part of the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife and Fish Refuge, or owned by the Corps of Engineers in support of the navigation channel in the Mississippi River. But a lot of the other components of the river are controlled by the state. So, for example, fisheries is something that's managed by the states, and water quality is something that the states have a role in flood management and all of these things. So, of course, this whole system is driven by the water that flows through it. You can't separate any of these pieces and just work on one thing at a time. So because you have different agencies who are required to, or who have different roles, it requires all of those agencies to come to the table to do things. One of the biggest collaborative efforts is this program called the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program, which some people may be familiar with. A lot of people who may not know what that means have seen some of the islands that have been built in the Mississippi River over the last couple of decades. And that program is a program that's appropriated by Congress to the Corps of Engineers to basically spend a certain amount of money every year on habitat rehabilitation projects within the Upper Mississippi River. And all of those projects require the coordination of the Army Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, and the state agencies, the State Departments of Natural Resources, in order to concur on a project. And that I was just at a meeting last week, and the official number for the program so far is that 102,000 acres of habitat have been restored. A large amount of that is aquatic habitat. So that's, you know, that's everything. That's fish habitat, that's waterfowl habitat, that's bird habitat, that's floodplain forest. But it's a huge source of funding for doing ecosystem restoration in the Upper Mississippi River. And that's one of those things that, you know, you never know what Congress is going to do, and you never know how funding priorities are going to change. And that's one of the key components of the partnership on the river, is having that funding source. And so anything that we can do to maintain that funding source over the long term is really valuable. Another component of the partnership is that there's a large committee called the Upper Mississippi River Conservation Committee, the UMRCC, which basically meets once a year for a full meeting, and then there are technical groups that meet at other times of the year, and that's where all of the state agencies and federal agencies actually sit down together and talk about what our objectives are. So I participate in a wildlife technical section that our objective is to maintain wildlife habitat in the Mississippi River. And I think the chair of that committee right now is a guy from Illinois DNR, and there's a mussel technical section and a water technical and a whole series of those things. So the Upper Mississippi River is a really neat example of partnership. And I guess one other thing I might add, specifically from the forest restoration perspective, we are guided right now by what we call the Upper Mississippi River Systemic Forest Stewardship Plan, and listeners can go online and do a search for that and should be able to pull it up. And that's a plan that's been supported by all of the state agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as a couple of non-governmental organizations. And again, it shows that tie-in with all of those different agencies in what we're doing and what the ultimate objective is of our management. And so it's a real privilege to work in a place where people actually talk to each other and find solutions to problems rather than creating more.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this Systemic Forest Stewardship Plan because, you know, I can you talk a little bit about, you know, why it's important to have this plan, this kind of roadmap, if you will, set in place?
It's important because, you know, as I said, you know, kind of putting everything into a context, there between kind of the Twin Cities and northeast Iowa, there are about 100,000 acres of floodplain forest, and that's distributed between Fish and Wildlife Service and the Corps mainly. But that's a lot of ground to cover. That's a lot of area to work in. And in reality, we're not going to be able to go out and do a management activity on every single square inch of that ground. So we need to have some way of identifying what our priorities are, what the most important things are. We need to be able to identify when a forest is in a condition where we probably don't need to go in and do anything for it. And there are a lot of places on the floodplain where they're just absolutely beautiful forests where trees are regenerating naturally, where the wildlife is abundant, where they seem to be doing just fine. So we don't want to go into those spots and mess around when we don't have to. But then there are other spots where either we've already got, you know, a conversion to a non-desirable cover type or a non-forested cover type, or where we suspect that conversion is going to happen soon. Silver maple is the most dominant tree species in the Mississippi River floodplain. I think about 85% of the trees are silver maple, and silver maple has a lifespan of about 140 to 150 years or so. The large majority of our trees in that species are about 70 or 80 years old right now, and so the writing's kind of on the wall in a lot of those areas that if these trees start to die and start to decline, and we don't have something coming up underneath them, then we're going to lose those forests, and it's going to turn into a non-forested cover type. So we need to be able to figure out which of those areas are getting close to that point where we need to do something in order to make sure that there's forests still there. And so the whole idea of this plan is to kind of give us a comprehensive idea of what our goals are, what our objectives are, and then how we go about reaching those objectives.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about efforts to restore floodplain forests along the Upper Mississippi River. We're here with Andy Meyer from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Andy Beebe from Audubon, Minnesota, and UWL biology professor Meredith Thompson. We've been mentioning, you know, work that's been happening all along the Upper Mississippi River, and I wonder if Meredith, if there are any success stories that really kind of stick out to you, areas that restoration work has been done and that have really kind of taken hold.
Yeah, so the big project that I've been involved with for the last 10 years, inspired by another colleague at the Upper Midwest Sciences Center of the USGS, ornithologist. So again, it's kind of this bird and forest connection that got me going on this work in the first place. That was an area that was forest cover was lost in the big blowdown here in 1998. Some people will definitely remember that storm. And so it's close to Goose Island. It was a site that had dense cover of reed canary, floodplain forest that came down in that storm, subsequently got invaded by reed canary grass, and then in about 2006, we started this project to restore it. And that's a great example of how, you know, the right management tools and sort of, it's always going to involve a certain element of luck in terms of the flood that you get or the flood years that you get. That is a site that is now on that trajectory, like I mentioned before, where the trees are tall enough, and I think we will see forest cover maintained there. That connects to forest that wasn't disturbed in that storm, and so that's another thing to think about is the way that you get that mosaic, again, even within forested sites, stands of different ages provide different kinds of habitat benefits to different types of animals. And so now we have a little chunk of young forest in the middle of that older forest. It connects to shrubbier areas and open water areas, and I'm really inspired to see that site now. It's a nightmare walking through it, right? So it's young trees that are approximately, 4 inches apart or closer. And so I'm not saying it's like I want to hang out there, but conceptually inspiring.
We like nightmares, though, because that means we've been successful.
That's right.
If we can't get into the site, we're happy.
Yeah. And Andy Beebe, I wonder if you any sites that come to mind that really could use some work, are there areas that are just, really needing these restoration?
You can probably drive up and down the river on either side and locate some large tracts of old agricultural land that now just is a sea of re-canary grass. Looks beautiful and lush, and if you're in the haying business, it's definitely good hay. But there is a ton of potential project areas out there that are just massive expanses of re-canary grass. And then lots of other landscape implications as well with Emerald Ash Borer coming into the scene right now and really getting into this area. And it's in La Crosse area, but just getting north at the moment. We have a number of ash stands of forests that are primarily made up of ash that are looking good right now, are largely unaffected by the borer, but presumably we're going to lose those trees within the next 3 to 5 years. So those are some of the areas that we're looking at right now, among many others, to get in and do some treatments and hopefully kind of work before the beetle, in this case, can get there and get some trees established so that when the ash does die, we're able to have trees growing up and taking their place.
Yeah, and I wonder if the threat of the emerald ash borer kind of speaks to why diversity among these forests is so important.
Definitely, it definitely does. I mean, it's an age-old story. We have Dutch elm's disease, we have emerald ash borer, we have, even as far as re-canary goes, I think Meredith mentioned the importance of diversity and how a cornfield is more diverse than a stand of re-canary, but diversity is always key. And I spent a lot of my life trying to explain that to people and having people understand it, but not on the same level, I guess, as maybe some more natural resource-minded people would think. And there's always this prevailing idea that it's still green, it's still a plant, and it's great, or at least it's good enough. But there are a lot of issues within the forest, like we've talked about, with tree regeneration. And then kind of deeper than that, just the relationship between native plants and native insects. So you have a lot of non-native plants that just have not evolved in this ecosystem whatsoever. They've been introduced sometimes as soon as 30 years ago. And all the native insects that our birds and other wildlife are dependent upon, the bottom tiers of the food chain there, don't have any associations with these plants. So it's essentially removing available food source, which then kind of just climbs up the ladder there. And as far as Audubon is concerned, takes food away from the birds.
Andy Meyer, I wonder if these restoration efforts weren't happening, what would happen to a lot of these sites? What would these sites look like in 50 years?
The simple answer is we really don't know, but we can speculate, I think, based on what we see happening. As I said earlier, and it's very intuitive, if you don't have young trees, you're not going to have old trees. That's just a very basic assumption. And if we don't do anything, we're certainly going to have areas that where we'll still have forests, and there certainly will be a lot of forest left. But there are a lot of areas where we see the canopy starting to open up, canopy trees starting to die, and where we don't see tree seedlings coming up, and those are in those areas, and that's a large portion of the floodplain. More than likely, it's going to convert into some sort of a non-forested system. So, if we kind of step all the way back to the historical times, this river was probably a series of braided channels with trees hanging over the waterways and just really complex system of interaction between forests and water. And we move kind of to the current time where a lot of those braided channels have disappeared, but the trees are still there, to maybe a period 50 years from now or 100 years from now where you're lucky to find an area where you've got trees hanging over the river and where you've got birds in those trees. And you know, there's even evidence that the fish utilize those forests. When the water gets up, they'll move into the floodplain forest areas and spawn within those areas and eat bugs within those areas, because there are a lot more bugs on tree leaves or different bugs than they maybe would be able to get in the water. And so people might think, well, you know, it's changing from one cover type to another. But the loss of forest as kind of a keystone component of this ecosystem could have some really major impacts on a lot of these very sensitive ecological communities that are here. And again, this is a really unique ecosystem. And so if you start losing that forest, which is kind of a linchpin of the whole system, a lot of those other ecological communities are going to show the effect, and it just won't be as pleasant of an ecosystem. You know, Meredith talked about all the great experiences she's had in the river, and I haven't been here very long, but I'm kind of the same way. You know, it's just a beautiful place, and if it was all grass, I don't think it would be nearly as beautiful as it is.
Meredith, once you reestablish these forests, you know, how is life different in that area once you do these restorations?
Yeah, so as we work on these restorations, one thing I should mention too is that we often get a lot of other plants besides the trees that we're trying to grow. There's a long-lived seed bank in wetland ecosystems, and so with my one project down by Goose Island that I mentioned before, we got 50-odd native wetland species coming into that site as well. It's not as diverse now because the trees are pretty dominating, but that's another piece of this puzzle. You know, flowering plants for pollinators, we definitely saw high levels of seed production for waterfowl to come in and eat when the water comes back up. So there's that element of diversity as well. Ultimately, as the forests age, we're going to see, you know, lower and lower light levels, and that starts to change all kinds of other things about nutrient cycling and water temperature and different kinds of habitat for the fish that come in during the high water events. There are a lot of different parameters that are changing. I'd actually like to ask Andy Beebe to talk a little bit about what we know happens in terms of water quality as you go from a site dominated by reed canary grass, at least as compared to a site dominated by mature forest. If we make that comparison, we also see some really big differences in nutrient cycling in those sites.
Yeah, Andy Beebe.
Yeah, definitely. So floodplain forests are massively important for water filtration and water quality. We all are pretty familiar that we're in a pretty heavily agriculture area. That's afforded us as a country a lot of benefits, but it definitely does have some impacts as well. That's not to say there's anything wrong with agriculture, but it definitely does impact the river. So water quality on the floodplain is massively improved by floodplain forests, whereas as opposed to reed canary grass, we have a lot of issues there. Floodplain forests reduce surface runoff by about 78% more than reed canary grass monocultures do, and they're able to do that because of the deep reaching roots that trees have versus the very shallow roots that reed canary grass has, and it just breaks up the soil and allows water to escape into the soil rather than just run off the surface over top of it. So that's probably one of the biggest ways that trees help actually infiltrate the soil, help water infiltrate the soil. Floodplain forests also act as nitrate sinks, so nitrogen sinks. We have a lot of runoff from agriculture that comes down the main river, is moving pretty quickly through the main river and spills over the banks and then gets stuck in the forest itself. We have, you know, wetlands within the forest, just pools that are on the forest floor where water becomes held up there. We have a lot of carbon material, dead wood that falls, rotting roots that allows that carbon or that nitrogen rather to denitrify and start to break down and become more available nitrogen for plants. So that's really the best way that the main way that floodplain forests affect water quality.
And Andy Meyer, you know, we're talking about a lot of these projects, but what are the end goals? How do you know when you've kind of, you know, reached the finish line in a sense?
You know, with any ecosystem, it's always changing, and we always have to be cognizant of what's happening. You know, I would say we would be able to hang up our hats and go home if we could demonstrate that on, you know, on 90% of our forested landscape that we were confident that we were going to have forest 100 years from now. We're nowhere near that. And the thing with forest habitats and in general, and the Mississippi River in particular, is that, you know, these habitats long outlast our human lifespans. And so a lot of the things that we're seeing right now are still probably effects of things that happened 50 or 75 years ago with the canopy trees and the regeneration problems. And so I don't think there's an end point or a finish line. I think this is a constant work in progress. There may be a point at which we can say that we feel more comfortable about managing less of it and allowing the system to work on its own. But inherently, this is a human-mediated system, and I think we just have to accept that, and we just have to manage it as such. And because it's a human-mediated system, I think that means there's a role for humans to play in maintaining the ecological integrity. I think what it gets down to is ultimately making sure that the river is able to provide for all of the different things that we ask it to provide for wildlife habitat, for recreation, for water quality, for all of these lists of things. And as long as we don't feel like it's doing that as well as it could, there's more to do.
We've been talking with Andy Meyer, forester for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Andy Beebe, forester from Audubon, Minnesota, and Meredith Thompson, biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, about regional efforts to restore floodplain forests along the Mississippi River. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.